Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators to bring you insights from the roads less traveled. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, where we talk to individuals about various topics within tech, venture, and the ecosystem in general. Today, I'm really, really pleased to invite Bronwyn Williams to the show. Bronwyn is a partner and trend analyst at Flux Trends in South Africa. She is a futurist and co-author of The Future Starts Now. I'm really, really happy to have you with us today, Bronwyn. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Not a problem at all. So you've been talking quite a lot about the breakdown of the social contract, which I think covers like a huge range of topics from education to work-life balance to kind of how we retire and where technology plays a part in all of those sort of things. So just talk to me for a second about why this is such an important topic for you. Why is it you've been exploring that so much over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting point, but it really does frame almost all the debates we're having, whether we're talking about the effect of cryptocurrencies on the economy or what's going on with protests across the world or what's happening in the world of work. We really are being forced to reevaluate our social contract. And in essence, our sort of post-World War II democratic nation state social contract is a trade-off. It's a trade-off in terms of security and freedom. So we give up some freedoms as citizens of a democracy where it's obviously ruled by consent of the governed in exchange for some security. So the freedoms that we give up are both physical and physical, as I like to say. In the physical sense, you sort of give up some of your paycheck in the form of taxation, in the form of all sorts of things that we pay for as being part of that society. But we also give up some of our physical freedoms, as in freedom of movement, having to use things like passports and border control and rules and regulations of having to wear things like seatbelts. So we give up some of those freedoms, and in exchange, we're supposed to get some security. And that's, of course, can be a valuable contract where it's win-win for all sides, but it is starting to break down. The way we've written that contract is no longer suiting the people who are paying for it with both their time and their money. So I can use an example here in South Africa, where I am at the moment, where most of the world has looked on with a little bit of horror as what's gone on with the sort of protests and looting and all of that. And what that really says is that our government is no longer able to provide us with physical safety and security in exchange for the money and time that we are giving up for it. And I think that those sorts of conversations are playing out across the world as citizens are looking at the impingements on their freedoms going on with responses to, say, things like COVID and with responses to things like social security welfare nets, saying that we are giving up too much perhaps and getting a bit too little in exchange. And other people are saying quite the opposite, that we need to give up even more in exchange for even more safety and security. And those conversations are playing out at a globalist level and in the political sphere, but they're also playing out in the workplace and in the arrangements between employees and employers, because that's essentially what the whole sort of salary worker trade-off is too. It's an exchange of freedom in exchange for security. So the freedom we give up as a salaried worker is our time. We're taking on a paycheck in exchange for which we are giving up our time. We are paid to work usually 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, depending on which country you live in and what your sort of working norms are in that environment. And in exchange, you get a guaranteed amount at the end of the month. So it really is a microcosm of what plays out in the sort of national social contract sphere, and they're both breaking down at the same point. So sort of a bit fractal almost, as you can see how the social contract has a whole lot of cracks appearing, and we're going to have to figure out what comes next and what that new trade-off is, whether it lands more on the side of security or more on the side of freedom, just like every generation, really.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's really interesting because a lot of that social contract kind of work happened post World War II, when the whole world was obviously going through a huge, massive shift and change. And clearly we're going through very, well, I wouldn't say very similar, we're going through shifts and changes now, but maybe in a very different way. One of the things actually that one of the quotes that I love from The Future Starts Now is that jobs that exchange a fixed amount of time for a fixed income are a relic of the industrial era that is rapidly being replaced by work that exchanges results for value, right? And you talked about it there, you're exchanging time for money and a guaranteed kind of income. But that's now changed, especially with kind of the onset of the gig economy, which is a massive, massive shift where labor laws and employment laws were very much derived for kind of the industrial age and, you know, the post-industrial age maybe even. But today those don't necessarily fit. So, and that's all been kind of enabled or driven by technology. So within all of this, technology is clearly kind of pushing some of those trends faster. Where's the tension there? How does one overcome that tension, or how does one actually work within that tension to either use the technology to help move us forward, or say at some stage, well, maybe the technology is holding us back or is having consequences maybe that are actually deleterious to society?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is the technologies that we have, whether you're looking at the sort of fintech space or at what's going on in the world of work, the technologies are forcing us to relook at that social contract, because whether we rewrite it or not, technology allows us to escape from our obligations from the contract that we know it. So we can talk about an example here in the world of work, which I think makes a lot of sense with a lot of people right now, particularly employers who have been paying people for their time and are now having to reevaluate that relationship in light of remote working and having to manage a workforce that is working from their own homes. From the employer's perspective, they're still paying that employee for their time. You're still paying for those 5 days a week. And that's what you're paying for. In exchange, though, the employee has started to see that, oh, I can get the same amount of value done for my employer within a less amount of time. So why should I not get both the freedom and the security? And of course, that's great for the short term. But in the longer term, you have to understand that this is a contract. There's people on both sides of that equation, and it has to be put back into balance. So we can't really have a situation where some people can have their cake and eat it too, and other people are paying for cake that they're not actually getting to eat. So again, that's quite a silly analogy, but I think it explains what's going on over here. So what technology now allows us to do is to force our hand in rejigging that contract. So the first thing it's done in the world of work is allowed us to work remotely, allowed us to have more freedom and still have our security of our paycheck on the employee side. But on the employer's side, employer that is thinking, wait a minute, if you can work, get your work done in a less amount of time, but I was paying you for all that time before, you know, maybe perhaps I've been overpaying you. I need to relook at how I'm remunerating you. They've also got technology to push back on that. So we can start to see the rise of things like in-home surveillance of your workforce. So if you are paying someone for their time, you kind of have a right to spy on them to make sure that they are actually working at their desk for those 8 hours. That sounds very uncomfortable, but that's the reality of the contract that we had previously. So technology is forcing our hand to renegotiate that. And what is likely to happen is those contracts are going to be rewritten in terms of value rather than in terms of time, which means we move more towards more people being remunerated more like freelancers, even if they are not freelancers. So it becomes a case of you'll get paid once you've done your chores, not you'll get paid once you've done your time, which is a mind shift that we're having to deal with right there. The same sort of thing plays out in the nation state level in terms of the obligations between citizens and their states. Again, as citizens, we have to pay our taxes in exchange for our safety and security, but there's an obligation for that government then to provide us with that safety and security, to provide us with physical safety in terms of law and order, but also to provide us with financial security in terms of things like social security, welfare, safety nets. So if one party is no longer holding up their side of the bargain, we have to reevaluate those contracts. And again, technology is forcing our hand and forcing us to renegotiate it. On the citizen side, much like with employees, we're now able to renege on some of our obligations by using things like cryptocurrencies to bypass a lot of the borders where we are sort of have to sort of pass go and pay our taxes. There are more escape routes available to those of us who are wealthy and tech savvy enough to take advantage of them. That's the reality. And regulators are going to find it very, very difficult to put that genie back in the bottle. That's not to say that they won't be able to make your life very, very difficult if you're not playing by the rules. But the point is that there are more ways for people to break the rules. And that means more people will probably be breaking those rules. It's easier to move money around the world. It's easier to look for those loopholes because there simply are more loopholes. At the same time, states, much like employers, now they have the ability to control, track, and monitor citizens to a degree that they were not able to technologically do until very, very recently. And the question then becomes how strong-armed that state, much like that employer, is prepared to be to ensure that the subordinate or the citizen or the employer or the employee is actually holding up their end of the sheet. So tech is really forcing our hand, forcing us to look at the loopholes that we have in our current contract and forcing us to make some very, very hard choices as to how hard ball we are prepared to play now that we have the ability to enforce that contract in ways that we weren't able to do previously.
That's super interesting. One of the things that's explored in the book, in the Future Starts Now, is this whole concept of when you're looking at the future, you think about it in terms of dystopia and then a path to utopia. Now, everything you described there, to me, was like highly dystopian in many ways. Do you think that that is where we're heading, or do you think that that is a possible outcome if we don't check ourselves now and start thinking how we can actually better utilize those technologies in a way that is not just acceptable to us, but actually meaningful to our lives? Because I think, you know, if anyone was to sit here and say and learn that, you know, okay, my employer is going to be observing every keystroke that I make at my desk whilst I'm sitting from home, that's probably going to be a huge, huge turn up for many, maybe not for all, but for many. Maybe for some it'll be motivational, I don't know, because some people prefer the stick to the carrot. I'm certainly not one of them, I would say. But yeah, are we at risk of moving towards dystopia rather than utopia?
Well, I would say it's likely, but it's not inevitable. And again, the solution is contained in the problem, as I've hopefully framed it today, that we have a choice now. Either we can get strong-armed if we are in positions of power, if we're paying people salaries or if we're government providing services. We can either get strong-armed in enforcing, trying to enforce our old social contract, in which case we are going to see a ramp up of more erring on the side of more security, but less freedom. But that's if we're trying to enforce a contract. And of course, the negative sort of externalities that come up with trying to enforce a contract that's simply not working for everyone because people are looking for ways to escape it is we have to become more and more strong-armed. And human psychology says, I mean, I've got a kid. I'm sure if you know any children, you know that if you tell kids to do say no on a certain thing, that makes that thing more desirable. Like we almost, if the more you try and enforce rules, the more people are going to look for ways to avoid those rules. However, if you approach rules from a point of more guidance rather than a point of being very, very specific, you can often get more buy-in with less strong arm control. So that's the unfortunate thing. And I can speak particularly at the sort of the business level. The more you micromanage and surveil your employees, the more they're going to push back against that boundary and do exactly the bare minimum. So if you're going to monitor my time and say that I'm only allowed away from my desk for a 5-minute toilet break every 3 hours, I'm going to take that full 5 minutes exactly. And I'm going to work exactly according to the clock. And in fact, the French, who of course know all about this sort of thing, have a certain strike that they do. It's actually a type of strike where it's basically a work to the letter strike. Well, you're not actually striking, but you're just doing exactly what you're told to do. And that's essentially a really low trust working environment. It's an environment where you have to have more and more control. And that's what we have to realize as political leaders or as business leaders. If we opt to try and enforce a social contract that isn't working on people or employment contract by the letter and we rule by law, we are going to have a low trust, high surveillance society. That's really the bottom line. That's where it tends towards if we choose to go down that path. But there is another path to actually say, wait a minute, if people are looking for ways to break the contract, maybe the contract itself needs to be rewritten rather than to be enforced harder. Maybe it needs to be redesigned so that it's win-win. And that quote you picked up from the book is really, really key to my sort of way of looking at this, is that if we do reshape our contracts in terms of value exchange rather than in terms of time exchange, we can create more win-win solutions. So of course, if you have been working for a freelancer for a long time, you're very familiar with this. You're very familiar that you get paid based on your output. You get paid based on how good you are and how much value you are bringing to the table. And it doesn't really matter how long it takes you to do it or where you're working from, because you are upholding your edge of that particular contract. But in exchange for that freedom, we have to be able to give up some of our security if we are in the receiving end of those benefits. And that means not being able to rely on getting a salary paid into your account on the 25th or the 30th of every month, but rather understanding that your pay pack is tied to the effort that you put in. So it means both sides have to give up something rather than both sides holding their ground. And that same sort of thinking does play out in the citizen-state relationship too. We can choose to be very, very hard-lining when it comes to the laws and the rules that we impose upon society, but we have to understand that the end point there is hugely dystopian. With every little bit of our agency that we give up as citizens in exchange for more security, once you've given that up, it doesn't really come back. You know, if you don't use it, you really do lose it. And the more we err on the side of fear and envy, and less we err on the side of independence and responsibility, well, the more we do tend towards more rule by law, hugely control-based societies. And we've really got to think very, very carefully about it, because it's not a case of we get to get everything. Life is not nice like that. We don't get to have our cake and eat it too. We have to give up some things in order to get other things. And I think I would encourage people to look at balance, to look at saying a full security control-based society or company is probably even less desirable than a full freedom, no security society. We need to draw those lines and say how far is too far, erring on either side, and what is each party prepared to give up in order to rewrite a new social contract based on value and not on time once again. And of course, the conversation taking place in the world of corporate and the conversation taking place in the world of economics and macro politics is actually very, very similar, because we have to understand that our economies are based on jobs that are based on time-based contracts, and our national budgets are based on taxation that is mainly, let's be perfectly honest, paid by your middle-class workers, because that's the only real strata of society that is not able to dodge their tax compliance, because it comes straight out of your pay packet at the end of the month. So we have to understand it's all interlinked. And what is the society we want? Control and surveillance based, or a society where a bit more, you know, individual agency and responsibility is put back on the table? We have to understand that that skin in the game has to be equitably balanced if our social contract is going to succeed. An unbalanced social contract is doomed to fail, and we're seeing our current contract failing all around us, whether we look at the protests, whether we look at the economic cans that are being kicked down the road. Wherever you look, you can start to see the cracks are appearing, and we have to act pretty fast in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think balance is a word that seems to have been lost to the annals of history, to be honest. I mean, we seem to be in a completely and utterly divided world everywhere you look. And maybe that's just the world of Twitter, but you do see it playing out kind of in media and across the globe in various ways, right? Whether that's anti-vax, anti-mask, whether that's pro-lockdown, anti-lockdown, whether it's, you know, something else altogether, right?
And you got to take the whole package, right?
Exactly,
you can't pick and choose. It's like it's the whole set menu. You take the whole...
It's either this, it's my way or the highway, right? And that's a really, really, I agree. I mean, a really, really negative way of looking at it, or a really poor way of looking at it, because, I mean, it's to your point, right? It's like a child saying, I'm going to hold my breath until you give me a sweet, right? And what do? You know, it's very black and white. Clearly, you make the child breathe rather than give them the sweet. Might explain some of my parenting issues myself. But anyway, coming back to kind of something you also talked about there, it's not just the middle class, but you're also talking about, I think, a middle class today being kind of the Gen Z, Gen X, like post-millennial, its entire cohort that has grown up in the, let's call it the late 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, you know, so we're in their 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe, who went through the old system, have sort of straddled both kind of the old world and the new world, if I can put it that way. And it strikes me that we kind of need a better entry point into the system and a better exit point from the system, right? And at the moment, in my mind, the education system, as an example, is not fit for purpose for the world that we are in and that we are moving further and further into. And also the whole social contract around retirement and pensions and so on, and how those are funded and who gets those, and should they even get them at the age of 65 or 70 or 80 or beyond, to me feels like it's completely outdated and outmoded given where we are. So it'd be great to understand kind of those two sides of the equation, because I think they impact how we deal with things moving forward. I mean, what are your thoughts on those?
I would absolutely agree. Again, our education system and our employment system, of which retirement is a part of, is once again based on training people to trade their time rather than to based around creating value and creating jobs rather than based around teaching people to add value to society. So I think it starts at the school level. I mean, our schools are based on time. It is compulsory in most developed countries across the world to send your children to school, not just until they know stuff, but to send your children to school for a certain number of hours a year, to the point where it actually becomes quite ridiculous. Again, it's sort of rule to the rule rather than rule to sense. So at the school my daughter goes to, for example, they sort of make up extra hours to make sure they get the right number of hours into the school day by having like the odd Saturday morning at school, but then the teachers want longer holidays. So they take sort of like cram all the schooling into a few months and then take a long break, which is just a silly example, but it goes to show that we're trying to rule once again by time rather than based on output. So if you have a bright kid, why does the kid need to spend 12 hours or 12 years in school for sort of 6 to 8 hours a day? I mean, some of the school days are getting really, really long now. Why is that not that if you know enough that you can sort of just go out and do what you want to do in the world? That would be the one sort of question. Again, it's that whole mindset of like teaching people to trade their time rather than teaching people to become valuable and valued members of society. Because it's a dignity component that we're sort of talking about here too. Again, schooling systems are generally set up to teach people to become employees rather than to become employers, which is I think quite depressing, you know, but it made sense for a world where the goal was to go and get a job, sell your time in exchange for your security and retire on time with that gold watch on your wrist, just in time to enjoy a couple of cruises before you sort of drop dead, right? I mean, that was the part of the social contract that we had. Very crudely put, but that's basically it. So why aren't we thinking also about what is the purpose of education right now? So the purpose was to get people into a job so they were sort of looked after. Once you got a job, your pension fund was funded through your own salary and that should sort of see you through to the end of your life. As that contract breaks down in the workplace, as we shift from being able to be salaried employees with a regular income that can be regularly budgeted by a very basic financial advisor, the financial advisor didn't even really have to be half bright to sort of figure out a pension plan that was based on a fixed sort of income that sort of increased the 5% a year over 30 years and then gave you enough to retire on. That whole system breaks on when you shift from selling time to start to selling value. Which means you got to go back to school once again and say, what is the purpose? If we are spending sort of 12 years on education, generally funded by, once again, the taxpayer, because everything is interconnected, to create an employer or employee class, that's going to come back and bite us very, very strongly, because those children are not going to be equipped in order to be value creating members of society. They're only going to be equipped to become employees in businesses that simply aren't going to be hiring them. Or if they are hiring them, are going to be hiring them under hugely onerous conditions with much more surveillance and much more sort of eyes watching on what they do and what they say and where they go. Because of course, all those controls over employees also relate to what you're allowed to say. You obviously can't say things if you're employed on social media that might not reflect company values. So that whole contract just becomes less desirable for really sort of everyone in the picture. And instead, we really should be looking at our school systems as to train young people to become independent, valued and valuable members of society. That's a very different objective to school, to train people to get a job. And that mindset's got to start really, really young. And we need to do that very, very quickly, because quite frankly, they're not going to be that many jobs available when young people graduate from school or university. And quite frankly, they probably don't want those jobs, because jobs are going to be the sort of thing that people that don't have other options are going to be forced to take. Jobs will come with much greater controls over what you're allowed to do, when, where you're allowed to go, what you're allowed to say. That's not so desirable. And then when you get to the other end of the scale, to the sort of retirement end of it, of course, retirements are currently supposed to be funded through that PayPack, through that regular planned income. When regular planned incomes fall away in the employable years of one's life, how do you then start to plan for retirement? Firstly, your income is now more erratic, so that whole sort of plan that you can look forward to becomes more precarious. Again, that trade-off between freedom and security. But also, it becomes a longer piece of string because our lifespans are tending to increase. COVID notwithstanding, our lifespans are tending upwards. And advances in medical science say that retiring everyone at a particular date just because they reach a particular age is going to put even more pressure on the greatest social contract. As in, if you've got everyone retiring at 65, but they're sort of hanging around to 95, 105, who's going to pay for that? Individuals have not saved up enough from that based on their increasingly erratic incomes. And they certainly haven't saved up for a retirement that's going to be, for most of us, longer than our employable years. So again, we have to reconsider that social contract. Telling a 14-year-old today they're going to get a job, work, retire, and have a comfortable retirement is setting them up for expectations that are simply not going to come through. The only way we solve that is instilling in that 14-year-old's mind that he's got to look after himself, because quite frankly, society's not going to be able to afford to do it based on the old social contract that we have. That's not to say that society can't help young people, but it cannot based on the model that we have now. Our post-industrial, post-World War II welfare, sort of democratic welfare states we've set up in most developed parts of the world are going to run into some trouble unless we are redefining how things are funded and by whom. And as long as we really have to understand that it all comes down to rejigging that contract to be based on value, not based on time, because it all collapses in and of itself when you start pulling at those threads.
I think that's hugely interesting. One of the thoughts that I always have around education, I completely agree, we should be thinking about how do we encourage our kids to become valuable members of society, not how do we set them up to become a lawyer, doctor, accountant, dentist, whatever it might be. But one of the things that I think about a lot is the reality of where tech is going with education as an example. And what I tend to see, especially with MOOCs and other kind of technologies of that nature, is that we're just digitizing content and feeding content, the same content in different ways to children, rather than rethinking the way we teach those children or what we teach them, right? How do you see technology potentially, again, accelerating that? Do you think that's easier said than done? Do you think that we're seeing trends in that direction, especially when you think about underdeveloped economies or less developed economies? Like, so for example, you know, on the African continent or in Southeast Asia, maybe, do we think that that technology has the ability to push those, I guess, those that aren't in the middle classes back up towards those middle class kind of trends? And, you know, how far away are we from having the majority of the population as middle class? And if everyone is middle class, what does that actually mean? Does middle class exist anymore? And again, to your point, the social contract breaks down even further, surely.
Yeah, so if the sort of macro trade-off is between freedom and security when it comes to society, when it comes to technology, the trade-off is really between efficiency and resilience. And sort of speak to your comments on what's going on in education. It's an amazing tool to use technology to improve efficiency in disseminating information to large groups of people at a much lower cost. Your best teacher through like a Khan Academy can teach hundreds of thousands, millions, in fact, of students, or more mediocre teachers. I mean, I hate to sort of say that, but the less great ones that weren't necessarily bringing out the best in their pupils suddenly find themselves kind of redundant. So that sort of brings me to the next point. So technology is great for efficiency. It's not necessarily great for resilience. Most of the technology that we have right now functions as an accelerator and also a sifter of the best from the rest. What technology is doing when it comes to the world of work, and this is where we've got to be very, very careful with education, is that it's allowing us to digitize the best of us. But what can be digitized can be, of course, automated. And what can be automated can then be replicated at scale, which means that almost all professions, not just movie stars and rock stars, almost all professions become rock star professions in that a smaller and smaller, super excellent minority accrue more and more of the actual value in that system. So it's great if you're the best, but it is very, very scary if you become the rest. So that's sort of speaking to more the sort of worker side of that equation. But the same thing filters through into how we're educating young people. If we are educating young people to become literal human resources, if we're using technology to simply make young people more efficient, then what we're doing is we're making our young people more machine-like. In other words, once again, we're making them better future employees, but perhaps less valuable individuals, in that as soon as we train people to become more interchangeable, they have less value going forward. And that's why we've got to be very, very careful about distinguishing between the sorts of skills that should be democratized and accelerated, and we should be pushing for efficiency. Skills like basic numeracy and basic literacy, being able to read fluently in your own language, by all means, use whatever technology available in order to facilitate that. Because once you've unlocked the ability to learn, which comes from basically being numerate and literate, then you're able to learn anything and go on your own adventure. And that's why we've got to be careful. We've got to be sending more individuals on individual journeys, because an individual is a lot harder to replicate, automate, and then thereby replace through technology or through the next best person in the field. So I think we're doing ourselves a disservice if we are using technology and education to make people more machine-like. We should be making people more human-like if we want them to be resilient in a more technological world, because the margin definitely does come increasingly from the mess, from the more human aspects of the economy. If you want to be resilient in your own career, in your own future, you need to be unique. You need to be unautomatable to as large a degree as possible. And of course, that is a tail-eating snake. Technology is always chasing us. But that's the skill we've got to learn. We've got to learn the skill to keep aside of technology, not to sort of ride that wave. And I think that a lot of countries, particularly sadly, countries in developing markets, are erring on the side of automating their future human resources by infusing perhaps too much technology into our syllabuses and not enough humanity. Because the only way you're going to be able to be a valued, valuable individual, an independent individual in a society, is if you are not completely interchangeable with every other person that's gone through the same system that you've gone through.
I think exactly. I think hit the nail on the head in terms of that kind of hyper-personalization, which is, I think, where the world is going to just in general, like not just in education, but across the board. I think, you know, one of the quotes that I also love, and I think, you know, this is a great kind of poignant place to maybe reflect on this and give some closing thoughts or get some closing thoughts from you. But one of the quotes is, maybe this was the time we should have asked ourselves what type of world we wanted to leave behind for future generations, a completely tech-oriented society or a human-oriented, tech-enabled society. And I think what you're talking about there is exactly that. Like, we can use tech to make ourselves better, but we should not use tech to replace ourselves, right? So if you had some sort of closing thoughts for our listeners, what would they be? What would be your advice on the future to those listening today?
Yes, I think it's probably important to note at this point that I'm quite pro-progress and pro-technology. I probably have more reservations about actual human beings, to quote Terry Pratchett, who we were talking about before we started this thing. Like, you know, and it's my pinned tweet on Twitter too. You know, artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. So I think that sort of frames my general view on sort of techno-positivism, but perhaps a little bit of wariness around what people do with it. And that brings me to that whole quote that you were talking about through the book around technology in the future. We have to understand technology should be a tool to allow us to live more prosperous, more flourishing lives. But if we allow technology to rule us, we're going to end up in a very, very dark place. Do we want to be ruled by technology, or do we want to rule technology in order to use all the abundance that we have and all the amazing minds we have on this planet and the amazing access to resources and new sciences to actually shape the world as we want it to be going forward? And it's very, very easy to defer to being ruled by technology because, again, coming back to how we started this conversation, technology helps us to feel safe. And safety is perhaps the most frightening thing for me at the moment. We are erring on the side of safety, which is ironically going to slow down progress. It's going to slow down just general joy in living and loving, to put it that way, because the real richness in life comes from humanity and through nature and through real experiences. And we simply cannot replace real experiences with technology and think that we're going to have as rich a life going forward. So should we be optimizing for longer lifespans? Absolutely. But let's think about quality as well as quantity. Let's think about resilience as well as efficiency. And let's think, hopefully, a little bit about freedom and responsibility, not just about safety and safetyism, because we have to find that balance and we have to use everything we have around us, not to rule us, but rather to support us in our ends as we hopefully move forwards, upwards and onwards, and not sort of downwards and out.
Amazing. I think that's a really, really wonderful kind of note to leave our discussion on. I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about your thoughts on what's happening in Africa, the future of the continent, given that, you know, by 2050, I think 50% of the world's population will be African, and, you know, just this incredible emerging middle class, the emergence of technology, and the fact that obviously a lot of the technology out in Africa is kind of leapfrogging Western technology because it's solving real problems on the ground rather than maybe just looking at how do we attract more consumers to consume more things. So maybe we're going to have to do a second session just on those topics. But for the meantime, I really want to thank you, Bronwyn, for taking the time out of your busy day to come talk to me. And it was absolutely wonderful understanding your perspectives on all of these topics that we talked about and the breakdown or potentially the renewal, let's hope, of the social contract. For our listeners, where can they find you? Where's the best place? Is that on Twitter? What's your handle?
If you want to argue with me, I'm on Twitter quite a lot, at Bronwyn Williams, quite easy to find. Otherwise, for my professional work, head on over to fluxtrends.com. That's fluxtrends.com. And we'll be happy to unpack trends as business and personal strategy for you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Bronwyn. And I really hope we do get a chance to talk again.
Absolutely. Lots to say on Africa.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. As always, we'd love to get your feedback on our conversations, your thoughts, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop us a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. But for now, be well, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of Nothing Ventured. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?